Please be seated. I can tell you that it is with the preacher's sensitivity that I'm going to tell you about something that I experience personally, but I am also making the assumption that you may experience this same reality as well. From time to time, I can find myself in a state that I describe as overwhelm. Somewhat different than stress or anxiety, those things more episodic, more dependent upon a cause and effect relationship of something that goes on in my life, but rather an extended period of experiencing the cumulative effects of stress and anxiety can bring to my life a period or a season of overwhelm. Now, when I look more carefully at what social scientists say about overwhelm, I am met with the reality that it's not something that I alone experience. But you, or most of you, or many of you, or almost all of you, if not all of you, experience this state of overwhelm from time to time in your own lives, in your own human existence. And something happens to us when we're beginning to enter that state. It's similar to stress or anxiety. The very first emergence of the signs of overwhelm are an increased heart rate. Perhaps we get sweaty, our hands may get a little wet, or we might feel a bit clammy. Our blood pressure rises. We become attentive to our surroundings and maybe hyper-attentive to the things that we are experiencing around us. As the condition persists over a long period of time, there is a cascade of other symptoms of overwhelm that we inherit. For many of us, overwhelm can manifest itself in our gut. Our gastro systems can become disrupted by this heightened sense of vigilance in our lives. That can look like vomiting and diarrhea, or it can just look like regular old upset stomach. But there is a real gastro manifestation that we can feel physically and begins to affect us socially and emotionally and spiritually as well. When we are in a persistent state of overwhelm, we can also experience more long-term effects. Studies show that folks under a persistent period of overwhelm can experience a significant reduction in our immune systems. We're no longer able to fight off the little bugs that our bodies normally fight off with relative ease or moderate effort, but we find ourselves plagued with those little bugs and viruses that normally would pass us by or move through our systems unnoticed. Those things begin to make us ill, begin to make us unhealthy. What we also know about overwhelm is that it's not just something that affects us individually. There is this reality that overwhelm can make an impression on systems or families or cultures or even whole countries of people. In fact, just like stress and anxiety, overwhelm is contagious. And it can hang over us like the proverbial storm cloud hangs over us in life in those illustrated cartoons that we see from time to time. Now, I suppose that there might be a few of you who are sitting in the pews this morning and thinking, like, God, Jimmy, like, really? Like, June 2nd, sunny day, here comes summer. Not only did we survive winter, but we seem to also survive a prolonged spring where we experienced rain and snow on a regular basis, and you're going to preach to me about overwhelm? Thanks a lot. I preached to you about overwhelm this morning because we have these curious stories that are informing our worship this morning. The primary one that I intend to preach about is the gospel, this episode where Jesus is engaging the religious authority again over and against the law, the way that we humans conduct ourselves in the world, the way that we creatures interact with and depend on one another in creation. And when we read this story, I can't read it all the way through without getting a sense that Israel, the people of this particular age, is experiencing a season, a protracted season of overwhelm. One of the things that we experience during a protracted season of overwhelm is a reduction in our mental or our rational acuity. We also are unable to access consciously and positively our feelings. We, in a state of overwhelm, lose our minds and lose touch with our hearts. And the reality of this story that we have from the Gospels is Jesus encountering a constituency of people just like us, people who are coming to church in the morning, expecting to embody the faith, and yet have lost their minds and their hearts when it comes to understanding the spirit of the law that is passed down through Torah, through sacred story, to the gathered assembly of people. They have become picky and prickly when it comes to the rules. The rules have become calcified and immutable and even unloving. It is as if the ushers and greeters outside on the steps, welcoming Jesus and his disciples to church, are less interested with the fact that here are more people coming into the community to worship God and care for and nurture one another, and more interested in observing the fact that Jesus' disciples have plucked grain and fed themselves as they made their way through the fields to worship in the morning. And that, the very plucking of the grain, would be in this calcified version of the law under this state of overwhelm would be seen as work, which is forbidden on the day that they would come to church. Jesus reminds them of a story of David and his followers early on doing something far more outrageous religiously than plucking grain on the way to worship. He reminds the crowd. They don't seem to have a sense of what he is reminding him. And so then he engages in this other act of work where he heals a man's hand, a man who is struggling in need of healing on a Sunday morning. That person is healed within the context of worship. And that also is viewed from that calcified perspective from the state of overwhelm as work. Israel has been under a state of overwhelm at this point in time for about 70 years. They have experienced occupation by the Roman government, and they have experienced a slow, steady, persistent, and successful erosion of their culture and their way of life, which centers around the single concept of relationship, of connectedness, of interdependence. Both Israel's relationship and connection to God, but more evident in daily life with our connection one to another. At the very center of the faith, the very middle point, is love one another as you have been loved and as you so desire to be loved. Being beloved and being a lover of others is at the very center of what we do. And yet, under a state of overwhelm, we can find ourselves in this position where we have lost our minds and we have lost a connection with our heart in such a way that we are unable to remember what is at the center of our faith. Now, I come to preach about this reality because, all in all, I tend to take a pretty optimistic view of humanity. I can remember about 10 or 12 years ago when Brené Brown published her book, Daring Greatly. She said something within the context of that book that stopped me in my tracks. And I really had to think about it for an extended period of time and wrestle with what she was saying. But the assumption that she wrote about in her book is that all of us, each of us, and all of us together are doing the best that we can. And when I first read over that advice, that concept, I was like, really, Brené? Really? Because, you know, there's some underachievement happening in human culture these days. There's some real struggles that we make, and maybe if we just tried a little bit harder, maybe if we just, you know, put nose a little closer to the grindstone, we might be able to bring about some more positivity into the world. But as I really wrestled with that, and as I intended to take that into my being, I have come to agree with Brené. I do think, for the most part, we are all doing the best that we can. We as individuals and we as a community are doing the best that we can. And yet, there is more love to spread. And there is more of a difference that we might make. We might even find ourselves, both individually and as a culture these days, as folks in a state of overwhelm. I'm comfortable with saying that about our reality in this present moment, even as I'm hopeful about being liberated from that reality. So what do we do about this reality, this somewhat heavy reality that we reckon with, 2024, summertime coming into full bloom right before our very eyes? And I think we get a hint of it both in the gospel section and in this reading that we have from the Hebrew scriptures in Deuteronomy. It's this wonderful passage about Sabbath taking. And I'll tell you a bit of a story in order to make the point about a woman named Tricia Hersey. Tricia Hersey founded something in 2016 called the Nap Ministry. At the time of the founding, Tricia was a student at Candler Theological Seminary. Candler is the divinity school that is attached to Emory University in Atlanta. In this particular moment of founding the Knapp Ministry, Tricia found herself in a state of overwhelm. At the same time that she was balancing many challenges in her extended family and in her immediate family, she was also juggling the sometimes overwhelming tasks of being a graduate student. And at one point in that year of 2016, she found herself at the end of her rope. And so she did something that is counterintuitive to most of us Americans, and she just dropped the work. And she did it from that theological perspective of rest-taking and Sabbath-taking, hoping that engaging this practice, this regular practice of rest, she might not just learn something, but she might find herself liberated from the state of overwhelm that she was experiencing. Her own private experiment worked. She did find herself encountering a measure of liberation, and she went on to think more and feel more and write more about this experience of a person who picked up the practice of rest-taking, of Sabbath-taking, and pushed it into her lives, somewhat counter the culture at the time and the results that that brought to her reality. She now, the sort of side or underground motto of the Knapp Ministry is rest is resistance. Resistance to the idea that humanity was meant just to be producing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, 365 days, and when we get to Jan 1, we just start all over again. Trisha's wisdom has spread across the church, and she's beginning to be engaged more popularly on social media, and she now calls herself the Bishop of Rest. I love that. I hope to meet the Bishop of Rest someday and to experience the wisdom that she has to share with us all face to face. Enfleshed. But I am nevertheless taking away the wisdom that both the sacred story has pushed towards us for millennia and the fresh way that Tricia has brought it to my own threshold. If you have listened to me preach week in and week out, month in and month out, year in and year out now, you know that one of the things that I like to do is to take this sacred story of ours and bring it to the center of our lives in some embodied or practical or logistical way. And so I will leave you with this morning, a measure of homework. As you depart this place today, your homework is to take a Sunday afternoon nap. Reconnect with yourself. Reconnect with the reality that there is a place where you begin and a place where you end, and yet we are always connected in the beginning and the end to one another. That it is not all about me or all about you or all about us. But nevertheless, God is, and God's Spirit is animating creation, and that we human beings can be sustained for the period of a 45-minute nap, for the period of a day every week, for the period of intervals throughout our day as we engage the 5-day work week. It's your homework, Sunday afternoon nap. If you can't do it on Sunday, do it on Monday. If you can't do it on Tuesday, do it on Tuesday. If you can't do it on Wednesday, do it on Thursday. If you can't do it at all, just give yourself a break. Amen.